Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio. I'm hosting from the mushing capital of the world, Willow, Alaska, and sitting beside me is the co-host for our flagship show, Dogworks Radio. Her name is Michelle Forto. She is my wife and business partner. And calling in from sunny California, writer-director of Mush the Movie, a documentary about the Iditarod, mushthemovie.com. His name is Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. How are you and Michelle doing?
We are well. Michelle, introduce the Iditarod fans to yourself.
I don't think I need any sort of introduction. If you are a fan of Mushing Radio, then you do remember that Alex and I did the show together last year.
You did, and you were covering the show in the studio while I was trying to be out there and about in the field. You guys did a miraculous job with that. One of our first few broadcasts on Mushing Radio, at least at the studio level.
Yes, that's right. And I was also on the past Mushing Radio for the Iditarod coverage all the way back in 2009 when we first started doing this.
There you go. Alex, it is becoming a wild race out there. Let's get a quick update before we move into our subjects this evening.
Yeah, so when we last talked to you guys, about 24 hours ago, Ali Zirkle had taken the lead, was the first team out of Caltag. Since then, the race has kind of been turned on its head at least once. Mitch Seavey and Aaron Burmeister chased after her shortly thereafter. They were running, they took the lead, and Aaron was leading most of the way into Unalakleet. Mitch Seavey, who has never won an official award during the race, as opposed to he's obviously won the entire race, but he's never won one of the trail prizes, was determined to be the first to win the first of the Coast Award for the first team to Unalakleet. He passed Aaron about 10 miles outside of Unalakleet and finished about and got in there 14 minutes ahead of Aaron. So Mitch Seavey won the First of the Coast Award. There were a lot of teams making really, really good time. But surprisingly, Jeff King seemed to come out of nowhere. He had the fastest time from Caltag into Unalakleet and currently is in third place. So Mitch, Aaron, and Jeff King are the only teams that are actually moving on the coast right now. And Mitch is a few miles ahead of Aaron, but Jeff King is only about 12 or 13 miles behind them. Following that, we have a pretty big pack now at Unalakleet. Ray Reddington Jr., Jake Berkowitz, who said that both he and his team are not feeling particularly well. Our Norwegian musher, Jort Olsen, Didi Genro, Ali Zirkle, Martin Boozer, Dallas Seavey, Sonny Lindner, and Nicholas Pettit. And it looks like just coming into Unalakleet right now or in the next few minutes are Pete Kaiser and John Baker. So the pack is definitely moving up onto the coast, and it seems like the weather is cooperating, or at least it's gotten to be a little bit more reasonable in the teens rather than being in the 30s and 40s. And then, of course, at night, colder, and there's that nice wind that always whips down the coast.
And, you know, Alex, I saw on Facebook today on the Iditarod feed that they're already prepping for the finish line. They're putting up the Burled Arch and setting up the finish line with the packed snow and all that. Looks like they're ready right now for a winner to stroll in there any time.
Yeah, it's been a very, very fast race, despite some pretty serious problems with the trail. We saw, and we've posted some of the pictures of some of the standing water and particularly outside of Iditarod, there was some overflow that was about 2 feet deep and looked like it was maybe 20 or 25 feet across that all the teams had to cross going into the checkpoint of Iditarod. But it looks like it's going to be a relatively fast race up the coast, and so we are on tap probably to see the winner come in sometime on Tuesday.
And like we said last night, hopefully we're able to report at least semi-live coverage of that event. I know that you have the Iditarod Insider and are staying glued to that, if not 24 hours a day, pretty close. Are you getting any sleep around there, Alex?
I am, and I apologize to all of our Twitter buddies that I keep nodding off around midnight or 1 in the morning and not following it all through the night like I should be.
Hey, that's okay. You know, last night we were talking on Twitter, and just for the folks that may not follow us on there, Alex is at Coldfoot Films, and I am at Dog Works Radio. We were even talking about making mead on the Twitter feed last night. What in the world are you guys doing down there?
Well, you know, I haven't actually made mead in a few years, but I used to be a pretty serious home brewer and would brew beer and brewed a couple of batches of mead. Mead is a fermented honey wine that's made basically with water and honey and yeast, and it's a pretty amazing thing. It takes a long time to ferment, but if you can make it and keep it around for a few years, it's absolutely fantastic.
Well, I'm thinking about whipping up a batch and having it during next year's Iditarod. It should be ready by then.
I think that sounds like a great project.
There you go. So here on Mushing Radio, we talk about everything, including drinking mead. So with that, I want to turn the mic over to Michelle. We're going to talk a little bit about a thing called the Musher's Widow. And she is usually the one on the sidelines, the one that is waiting for us to come in from the trail at God knows what hours of the night. She's always there wondering where we're at on the trail, because with the nature of technology, we can often find out where we are, but sometimes it makes it a little difficult. And I'm sure right now there are 66 people waiting at home somewhere thinking about where their musher is. And you always hear on Facebook about how they can't get in contact or have updates of where their loved ones are. So it is a real concept. Michelle, tell us a little bit about that from your experience. I know we're not Iditarod mushers, but at least you are the one that are thinking about the folks out on the trail.
Well, you know, I've been following your mushing career since the late 90s, and I can tell you that the advancements in technology, and even with social media and our little radio station here, the advances for communication and being able to track these mushers, it has come so far in such a little bit of time. So I'm very impressed with our ability to follow the mushers in today's times, especially with the trail going as fast as it goes. I know that when you ran some of the stage stop races and the longer distance races down the lower 48, just when I met you, that it was extremely difficult to get information about where you were. You really had to rely on those checkpoint volunteers to call it in on their walkie-talkies up to the next checkpoint to get any sort of information about how you were doing, how your dogs were doing. Many times I know we have volunteered in the past where you all of a sudden you get calls 2 or 3 days after a dog's been dropped. You better go pick it up. Oh, we had no idea. But I'm going to talk a little bit about, the musher's widow isn't necessarily his wife, especially nowadays. It could be the husband. It could just be the kids. It could be mom and dad. It's all the fans for sure nowadays. I know that one of the biggest things out there for these mushers is their fans, and that's one of the things that keeps them going out on the trail, because they'll hear back, they'll get home, and they'll read all of these Facebook entries that say, go, go, go. You know, Allie's got a big following, Lance Mackey's got a big following, everybody's got a big following. So we're all kind of widows out there for these mushers. But I'm going to read a little bit of history about the Widow's Lamp. It's a little different than the Red Lantern, which everybody knows is what you get for coming in last place. And the Red Lantern actually was a prize given out during the Fur Rendezvous. Long time ago, back in the 80s, is where the Red Lantern originated. But the Widow's Lamp is a little bit more historic for Iditarod. And it was a lamp lit at roadhouses in Alaska to guide dog drivers. During the days of Alaska sled dog freighting and mail carrying, dog drivers relied on a series of roadhouses between their village destinations. Since these mushers ventured out in most all kinds of weather, for safety reasons, they found the idea that pilots rely on, known today as the flight plan. Word was relayed ahead that a musher and team were on the trail, and a kerosene lamp was lit and hung outside the roadhouse. It not only helped the dog driver find his destination at night, but more importantly, it signified that a team or teams were somewhere out on the trail. The lamp was not extinguished until the musher safely reached his destination. In keeping with that tradition, the Iditarod Trail Committee will light a widow's lamp at 10 a.m. on the first Sunday in March in Nome at the trail's end. This lamp, which will be attached to the Burled Arch, our official finish line, will remain lit as long as there are mushers on the trail competing in the race. When the last musher crosses the finish line, officials will extinguish the widow's lamp, signifying the official end of the Iditarod for that year. That is also when the Red Lantern is finally awarded to that final musher, because they incorporated that award from the Fur Rendezvous to the Iditarod, just because it was something ceremonious to do and give out that Red Lantern. I think it's quite fitting that we're discussing the Widow's Lamp this evening, as well as the Widow's Musher, along with our Rule 36, because that rule has changed significantly over the past decade or so. It was something that I know Robert and Alex, you guys are going to discuss, but wasn't always a rule where, you know, you had to be so many hours behind the musher that crosses the finish line. Isn't that correct?
That is correct. And I know that right before airtime, Alex and I were talking about how they've changed it just this year. Excuse me. But what's important here is, like you said, everybody, just about everybody out there has somebody that is waiting for them. And sometimes there's quite a bit of stress involved with that, isn't there, Michelle?
Oh, absolutely. I can speak on it for firsthand. This year was the first year that I actually got to follow you on a spot tracker when you attempted to run the Testamina 200. And that was a race that you probably should not have entered. As you know, you were 4 days past bronchitis, and the hills proved to be more than you expected. You know, and we're from Colorado, so it was quite taken aback by that. But following you on the spot tracker isn't as easy as it may sound. It doesn't always give an accurate position of where you are, and it doesn't exactly give me the opportunity to call you up and say, hey, did you remember to change your socks? Are your feet wet? Have you eaten? You know, and I know Robert well enough that he takes care of the dogs first and foremost, and one of his fallbacks is that he does not take care of himself along with the dogs. And a lot of the mushers, that's one of the major problems. They forego eating and sleeping and drinking enough water for themselves and making sure that they have dry clothes on, and they're not able to help their own dog teams, you know, when push comes to shove in some of these situations. Like you mentioned, Ray Reddington Jr. is not feeling so well, and neither are his dogs. He may have pushed a little harder than he thought he could.
Alex, what's your take on that, or do you have any comments for Michelle?
Well, you know, first of all, I want to point out that Michelle, in addition to being the behind-the-scenes person, is also a musher in her own right, although more of a, I guess, a recreational musher. But it has gotten a lot easier for fans to follow where teams are. The idea of putting these GPS devices on sleds, which now not only happens on the Iditarod, but on a lot of the smaller mid-distance races, makes it very, very exciting and makes it possible for us to follow the race in a way that we haven't been able to do in a while from a long distance. As Michelle pointed out, it's not perfect. A lot of times you'll notice that that the information that the trackers are showing is 10 minutes old or 45 minutes old, and it's sometimes hard to tell exactly what's going on. And, of course, when someone is stopped, you're not always sure if they are stopped because they're in distress or if they are stopped because, you know, they're snacking the dogs or if they planned stop or they're camping. So that can be a little bit disconcerting as well. That said, it's a lot more exciting for fans and people following the race to be able to have a much more up-to-date look than just seeing when people came in and out of checkpoints. I wanted to point out that anyone, fans, can send what they call mushergrams to individual mushers. You can call the phone room at the Iditarod, which is 907-248-MUSH, and send a message to any of the Iditarod teams that you're following, and that message will be brought by the Iditarod Air Force and delivered to them at a checkpoint. So you can send a particular greeting or cheer or word of encouragement to any of the mushers that you're following.
Very cool. Michelle?
You know, Alex, I just wanted to add out there for all the fans that know Robert and I, Nicole, our daughter, ran the Willow Junior 100 this year, and I was a little bit pushy in getting permission to put that spot tracker on her sled. She was the only little musher out there with the spot tracker on her sled, and I'm going to tell you that the race officials and the people that put on this race are considering making that mandatory for the kiddos next year, because for me, being that widow, was harder for me to send my little girl out into the unknown of her own backyard trails, and I'm going to tell you, it's still the unknown. So I felt much better watching that spot tracker, but I'm going to let you know that Robert watched it more so than I did.
24 hours. I had that on. I was sitting there in front of the laptop. Alex, anything else on the widow's musher or the widow's lamp?
I think that the widow's lamp is one of the most amazing things about the Iditarod. And literally, it's placed under the Burled Arch in Nome, and it stays there. It stays lit until the last racer comes off the trail. The past few years, the Red Lantern team has been coming in before the finisher's banquet, which is usually 2 weeks from the start of the race, so it will be next Sunday. And if the Red Lantern comes in before the banquet, it's easier for people to come in, for people to come out and greet them. But there's a tradition, if the Red Lantern team comes in during the finisher's banquet, everybody leaves the finisher's banquet and goes downtown to greet the Red Lantern team as he or she comes in.
Very cool. You know, like you said a couple of broadcasts ago, many mushers still come out no matter what time of day or night, and you mentioned how Lance Mackey did that when you were there. You know, they pay respect to each other, whether they're first, 30th, or last, don't they?
Absolutely. And it is definitely an accomplishment, and it's something that all of the mushers who've completed the race and all of the fans certainly celebrate.
So with that, we're going to switch gears a little bit, and we're going to talk about Rule 36. We have about 10 minutes left of our broadcast, live broadcast, which is also simulcast on KVRF 89.5 here in the Natsu Valley. If we do run over, you can listen to us anytime at mushingradio.com after we end our broadcast. You can listen to any of our podcasts there, and it will be up there within a few minutes after our show. So if it cuts off when we're on, just hang in there. You can always listen to us well into the evening. Alex, what do you know about Rule 36? I know that it's changed a little bit. It's called the competitiveness rule.
Right. And currently, what the rule reads, and I have it in front of me, so I'm just going to read it real quick. A team may be withdrawn that is out of the competition and is not in a position to make a valid effort to compete. The race marshal may consider but is not limited to weather, trail conditions, and the overall pace of the race when invoking this rule. Prior to this year, the first part was the same. but then there were specific time limits, and if you were beyond those time limits, you were considered non-competitive. So the time limit was if a team hadn't reached McGrath within 72 hours of the leader, either Grayling or Galena, depending on whether it's the north or south route, within 96 hours of the leader, or Unalakleet within 120 hours of the leader, they were presumed that the team was non-competitive. I think, and I don't know exactly why it was changed, but there always was a lot of latitude and a lot of, there was a lot of latitude given to the race marshal to decide when or whether to invoke this rule. And I think taking the time limits out probably made it clearer that it was up to the race marshal. I think that this is always a controversial rule when it's employed. There were a couple years ago, I remember Hank De Bruin was withdrawn for being non-competitive, and he was very upset because he felt well within those time constraints. But the race marshal ruled that he was too far behind and was not competitive, so he was withdrawn from the race. Now, there's a couple reasons why a racer could be withdrawn from the race. The Iditarod is a very, very long and complicated race that requires a lot of logistical support. And although many of the remote checkpoints are staffed locally by people who live there, there are veterinarians and race officials and volunteers who have to be flown in and out of the race. And especially later in the race, when there might be teams spread out over 300 or 400 miles, it can become very difficult to have to work out how to staff and coordinate all of the different people in all of those checkpoints.
That's exactly right. As you mentioned, they pretty much just piggyback or leapfrog from one checkpoint to another. I know the vets in particular, they will be at one location, and then the next day as the race progresses, they'll be at another location, and they just jump back and forth until they reach that final destination of Nome. And, of course, some of them are going back the other way as well for the later mushers, whether there's a veterinarian, let's say, in Unalakleet, they might go back towards McGrath or Cowtag or one of those other places to catch up the behind the pack guys. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. And you know, the other thing to point out is that the race marshal this year and for the past several years, I'm not sure exactly how long he's been doing it, is a guy named Mark Nordman, and he is himself an Iditarod musher. He's a guy who has run and completed the race. So he's certainly someone who is very familiar with what it's like to be running the race, in addition to being someone who has been charged with making sure that the race runs smoothly. I don't know him very well. I've met him a few times. He takes what he does very, very seriously. I don't think that the decision to withdraw Musher for being non-competitive is ever made lightly. It's not the sort of thing I would want to be charged with doing, because I imagine that it will make a lot of people angry. That being said, it seems like the rule has, at least when I've been following the Iditarod, has been invoked more often than not when there is a single musher straggling along at the end of the trail. If there's a couple of people running together who are at least continuing to make progress, it doesn't seem to have been invoked for multiple people. And I could be wrong about that, but that's been what I've observed.
Now, Alex, I have a question, if I may. Now, watching this in the years most recent here, we're seeing the record times being made. You know, I mean, they're blowing apart the field. When I first became familiarized with Iditarod, they were still running it in 10-day time periods, okay? And I know to some people that seems like, oh, my God, 10 days. Yeah, it was 10 days when I first got interested in Iditarod that they were finishing it. And don't ask me who won that year. I couldn't tell you. But now we're running it in in 8.5 days, and it's looking like this year might even be a little bit faster than the year before while on this southern route. How much slower is the slowest team going compared to the fastest team as far as miles per hour?
The slowest team seems to be coming in around 3 or 4 days later. So maybe if the fastest team is going, 7 or 8 miles per hour, the slowest team perhaps would be going 4.5 to 5.
Right. And, you know, Alex, we have about 3.5 minutes left here on our live broadcast. I want to finish up this topic before we move into the next one, which will probably be on our recording side. But I know that there's a very specific procedure in order to withdraw yourself or scratch yourself. I know that you've talked about this in the past. I believe we talked about it last year. You just can't say, okay, I'm scratching, that's it. There's something that has to be done. And I know we talked about it last year with a guy in safety. Do you remember what that is?
Yeah. Specifically, you have to talk to the race marshal before you can officially withdraw. Or scratch. And I think with regard to the competitiveness rule, I think there are times when people will get the call from the race marshal and they will be pressured to scratch rather than to have to be forcibly withdrawn. And that's always kind of an iffy thing too, and a lot of people have bad feelings about it because they feel like I'm doing this against my will, but they are, my understanding is they are pressured to scratch rather than officially be withdrawn, and if they don't, they will be officially withdrawn. But in order for that to happen, you have to talk to the race judges and you have to talk to the race marshal.
And, of course, there could be times, I know in one case in particular who we just mentioned, there may be a little bit of avoidance there. I just can't get a hold of that guy. I'm here or there, and I just can't reach him for whatever reason. That could come into a little bit of a cat-and-mouse game.
Right. And I would imagine also if you are running in the very back of the pack, the last thing you want to do is be in a position where one of the officials will say, hey, you have a phone call, and you have to go and talk to the race marshal.
Right. So just to finish up this topic, Alex, it looks like Mitch Seavey, Aaron Burmeister, Jeff King, all of those guys there at the front are doing very well, and we're thinking about finishing sometime Tuesday. But then at the back of the pack, we have Cindy Abbott and James Volek, who are now in Iditarod or shortly thereafter have left. Are we going to find any issues here, you think, at least with this 36 rule?
I don't think so. They were both well within the time period that was in effect last year when they got into McGrath. It looks like they are almost in Grayling, or they will be in Grayling probably sometime tomorrow. According to the old rules, they would have to have been in Grayling, I believe, Tuesday afternoon, and then into Unalakleet by Friday in order to fall within those 5 days. So it looks like if they keep going at the pace that they're going now, that they should be okay. The other thing I just wanted to point out quickly about being withdrawn is there have been a couple of cases where mushers have officially been withdrawn from the Iditarod, but have continued up the trail. And they have said, well, you know, I'm here with my dogs and I'm going to get to know them under dog power. Now, when that happens, the checkpoints aren't officially staffed. Their times in and out aren't recorded anymore. But there have been times where mushers have been withdrawn and have decided that since they were out on the trail and far enough down the trail that they would just continue unofficially to keep going and run until they got to know.
There you have it, guys. We're about ready to end our broadcast on KVRF. You can hear us still at mushingradio.com, and we will continue on here in just a second. And we are continuing on here on Mushing Radio. It is day 8, I believe, of our coverage. The days are starting to run together. And we are talking today about day 9. See, there you go. We are on day 9 of our coverage, day 8 of the Iditarod. We started on the day of the ceremonial start. Today, Alex, we are going to talk about our featured musher, as we do every evening here on the show, and it is Kelly Griffin. What do you have to say about Kelly?
Well, Kelly Griffin is one of these fantastic, quintessentially Alaskan mushers. She was born in Minnesota, and when I believe she was 3 or 4 years old, she moved up to Alaska with her family, was raised in South Central Alaska. She's said that she started mushing recreationally when she was a teenager, and when she got out of college, she put together a dog team with dogs that she got at the pound, and sort of made a lot of early mistakes with those kind of dogs before she got serious about it and started putting together her own kennel. This recently, she combined kennels with Kathleen Fredericks, who's another Iditarod musher. I believe she had under 30 dogs when they combined the kennels. She has run the Yukon Quest 9 times, and her highest finish was 5th. She was the first woman to run both the Iditarod and the Yukon Quest in the same year, and she finished both of them. She now is living up in Wasilla, which is, used to be kind of out in the country, but in the past 10 years has kind of grown up a lot, and there's a lot of people who've moved up to Wasilla. It's a much bigger city than it was 10 years ago. She ran the Quest again this year and scratched in Dawson City. Just tangentially, I wanted to say, if people don't know, and I think most listeners will know, Yukon Quest is what is sometimes called the other 1,000-mile sled dog race. It runs between Fairbanks and Whitehorse, and every year they switch the direction. So one year it'll run from Whitehorse to Fairbanks, and the next year it'll run from Fairbanks to Whitehorse. It's held in early February, and it's considered a race a lot less light in February than there is in March, and the temperatures tend to be a lot colder. And the other interesting thing about the Quest is that it has fewer checkpoints, and the checkpoints are a lot farther apart. The checkpoints also mostly are on the road system, so a lot of mushers will have handlers and teams who follow them on the road and then meet them at each checkpoint. I had the pleasure of interviewing Kelly before the start in 2011, and the thing that impressed me most about her was, in addition to her being just very down-to-earth and very matter-of-fact, one of these people who runs dogs, knows a tremendous amount about running dogs, has been a solid middle-of-the-pack musher for many years, and has accumulated a lot of knowledge about raising dogs and about the race and about living in Alaska. What really impressed me about her is a lot of mushers were wearing these very, very fancy jackets and snow pants that had logos from their sponsors and everything. She was wearing this pair of snow pants that had a hole in it that she had fixed with duct tape. And as most people know, duct tape is sort of the official everything of Alaska. You come up to Alaska and you will see duct tape everywhere used to fix and hold everything together. In the off season, she runs a small farm and raises horses and chickens, and I believe sells eggs and some of the chickens to make money. She's a wonderful person with a really nice sense of humor, and she is currently in let me see if I can figure out where she is. She's currently in Caltag and is in 28th place. So, again, pretty solidly in the middle of the pack. And I know that, Robert,
you know,
had spoken to Kelly on Mushing Radio, and I wanted to know what your impressions were as well.
Same impressions, and that's what I was going to mention. I had a chance to interview Kelly right around Thanksgiving time, I guess it was, when they were just in the middle of prepping for this year's Iditarod, thinking about who was going to run what in terms of qualifying, or not qualifying, mid-distance races and that sort of thing. And I know when we talked about Newton Marshall the other day, Kelly Griffin and Newton Marshall and Kathleen Frederick are very tied together this year. They all shared dogs, shared kennels, shared races together. And as you mentioned when we profiled Newton the other night, Newton wasn't going to run this year. He was down in Jamaica, and Kelly had gone down there for a vacation, and we talked about that on the show. And she happened upon Newton at where he was down there, and they struck up a conversation and a friendship, and the next thing you know, he was on his way to Alaska to work with Kelly Griffin and Kathleen Frederick with their kennel. So it's kind of one of those things where, you know, come on up and we'll help you out if you help us out. Very typical Alaskan musher type of way that we do things. And I think it's such a cool story because, you know, Newton Marshall and his story is just so amazing. But when you add in somebody like Kelly, who most people don't know much about. I mean, she's not the big flashy name like you mentioned, Alex, with the fancy dog truck and the sponsors and, you know, all that sort of stuff. She's just a down-to-earth Alaskan musher. And, you know, that's the stories that we're trying to tell here, and I'm glad we were able to talk about her this evening.
Yeah, and, you know, when I think of the Iditarod, that's the sort of spirit that I always think about. The people who are not going to have a top 10 finish, are not going to be the serious contenders who are going to be, you know, rushing up Front Street and winning the race, but the people who are out there day in and day out, you know, and who are just devoted to their dogs and devoted to the sport.
Exactly. And, you know, one thing about Kelly, when I spoke with her this past fall, she was so interested in talking about Newton, about his book that just came out, about how they were going to meet at this place and that place. I know they had an upcoming book signing at Sportsman's Warehouse up here, and she wanted to talk about him more than she ever wanted to talk about herself. And I thought that was pretty humbling on her part and pretty amazing that she wanted to let somebody else shine. She didn't care if she was in the spotlight at all.
Yeah, and I think that there are a lot of mushers who are relatively modest, not as outgoing, and she definitely falls into that category, and yet is someone who absolutely is able to get out there and get the job done.
Exactly. If she's in 28th place, she's above half of the, you know, in the top half of the pack, so to speak. So doing very well, and I have a feeling that she's going to finish pretty strong. You know, can you mention just very quickly, Alex? We often don't talk a lot about the money positions here on the radio. It's more about the stories. But in Iditarod, the first 30 mushers, the top 30 mushers, are what they call in the money. Can you tell us a little bit about that before we go tonight?
Yeah, I don't have the exact breakdown in front of me, but it ranges from the first prize, which this year they get the truck, and then I believe it's $50,400, and then it goes down with each place, and after 30th position, I believe all of the finishers get $1,049, but anything above $1,049 is considered in the money positions.
Right. And we talked about just the other day that very expensive belt buckle that all of those mushers are coveting after, whether they're in first place the first year that they're running, which is pretty atypical for somebody that gets their first belt buckle to win the race. But even that last place finisher, they may be looking for that that Red Lantern, but they're also coveting that belt buckle as well.
Yeah, and Kelly has, this is Kelly's, I believe, fifth Iditarod. She first ran in 2005 and finished 46th place, and ran again in 2008 and was in 45th, and in 2011 finished in 26th place, last year in 27th place. So it looks like she is on track to have a finish that is at least as good as what she's done in the past.
So Kelly Griffin is our featured musher this evening. Alex, do you have any update on any of the dogs that have been so popular, at least on social media? Is that maybe a blessing or a curse in terms of the updates on some of the dogs, whether they're lost, injured, hurt, whichever? Excuse me. Any news on May or Wyatt, one of Lance's dogs? Excuse me. Can you tell us the story about Lance and how he broke a tooth and all that?
Yeah. You know, Lance Mackey is, I'm not exactly sure how he broke the tooth. I just heard about that before we went on the air. I know that because of his cancer treatments, he doesn't produce saliva. So when you see Lance, he is constantly drinking water. He always has a water bottle by him, and that has caused some issues. But I believe that, did he run into something? Is that what happened?
I haven't heard the story. All I heard, and you know, it's a typical Lance Mackey story. He pulls into the checkpoint, grabs a piece of gum, shoves it up there against the exposed route, and goes to start to tend to his dogs. That's a story you hear about Lance all the time. He doesn't care where he's at in terms of his, you know, he's just a go-getter. Give me a piece of gum. I'll fix this tooth, no problem.
You know, I'm sure the fans will be able to see it on his documentary that's being filmed while he's out on the trail this year.
Yeah, we've talked about that for sure. But other than that, I don't know what happened, Alex.
Okay. I know that they're still out looking for May, who is the dog from Newton Marshall's team. There also was Wyatt, who was Lance Mackey's dog, who was airlifted from Caltag, from Eagle Island to Caltag. And apparently the vets were very concerned about him, but he seems to be doing much better, and was up and around and will be fine. I also had heard that Jerry Willemitzer had lost the dog briefly, but was able to recover the dog and continue on the race. And he had lost
two dogs
a few years ago in 2011 or 2010 as well. So, you know, as you pointed out yesterday, it's almost definitely a dog that was being carried in the basket. So, you know, that is something that happens from time to time.
It is. And as we mentioned just the other day, if you do lose a dog and you cannot recover him for whatever reason, you are forced to scratch. And I believe that's what happened to Newton Marshall when he lost his dog, May. And it's my understanding, at least from the reports, is that was Jim Lanier's dog, one of his famous white huskies. And his wife flew up from down here in the Anchorage area to go help look for that dog. So pretty amazing story in its own right. I know we talk a lot about the mushers on here, but there's a lot of stories about those dogs as well.
Yeah, and some people have been talking on Twitter and on Facebook about the idea of putting individual GPS trackers on each of the dogs. The problem with that, of course, is that the trackers need to frequently have their batteries changed or else carry a battery pack that is pretty much too heavy to put on each of the 16 dogs.
And can you imagine the logistics of trying to keep track of 1,000, 1,200, 1,300 dogs with all these little beeps and updates going on constantly?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to do that.
I totally agree. So, Alex, we're out of time here. Anything else in closing?
I just want to add real quickly that Ali Zirkel and Your Olsom, as well as Ray Reddington Jr., are out of Unalakleet, so they're going up the coast as well. well, and right now it's Mitch TV, Aaron Burmeister, and Jeff King about 10 or 12 miles back.
What are some of the other checkpoints there from Unicolete? What are the next few up?
From Unicolete, it goes to Chaktulik, Kayuk, Elam, and then White Mountain.
So
and then, of course, safety
left,
and now.
We get to the end.
Yeah, and the checkpoint distances start to be greater in the last part of the race as well.
There you go. Michelle, anything in closing?
No, I wish everyone well. Alex, it's been wonderful listening to your commentary this year. And, you know, I'm on the edge of my seat for who's going to be coming in first. But I like it when we continue our coverage all the way through to the end.
Yeah, we're going to be giving it a shot. As of last year, because there's a heck of a lot of race behind those first 10 or 11 racers that finish on the first day or so. Alex, what's your schedule? What are we looking like in terms of nightly broadcasts?
You know, I think we're going to continue as long as we can. We're definitely going to be on the air through the first finisher probably for a few days after that.
There you go. 6 o'clock Alaska time, and then, of course, thereafter on mushingradio.com. Lots and lots of listeners are listening after our broadcast as well. So people are liking what they're hearing, and we would love to hear you guys' comments, questions, and concerns. You can hit us up on Facebook. Alex is at Coldfoot Films, and I am at Dogworks Radio. And make sure you head on over to our Dogworks Radio page at Dogworks Radio on Facebook and ask those questions and comments. We'd be happy to answer them. And typically, as Alex said, he tries to go to bed at about midnight, but we're usually pretty active back and forth for the next several hours after the show. Alex, do you have anything on tap this evening that you want to talk about, or are you just going to give some news updates or some stories that you find, anything interesting happening, at least in the Twitter world?
You know, I would like, if I could, and I apologize in advance for pulling this, but I would like to ask Michelle who you're rooting for and what do you think the next 3 or 4 days are going to have in store?
She already took off her headphones, but let me ask her the question. Alex had asked, who are you rooting for, and how do you think the next 3 or 4 days are going to pan out for these mushers? I know who she's going to say already.
Yeah, well, Alex should, too, because if you remember, I am cheering for Allie Zirkle. I think that she is one hardworking musher, and, you know, I have been rooting for a woman for quite some time, but actually since we started doing the show in 2009, I've been rooting for Allie, and I hope that she can make it happen this year. But, you know, these guys, these older gentlemen out on the trail, these four-time Iditarod champions, you know, they are seriously out there looking for that fifth championship. I know that that's what was on Boozer's mind. I know that's what was on Mackie and King's mind when they saw that he ran straight to Roan. And I think it's still anybody's race at this point. I really do. There is a lot of tough terrain between Unicolete and Whitehorse.
There is. It's all that coast running, all that sea ice that's going to happen. And, you know, just like every year it seems to happen, somebody gets lost there on that sea ice. Sometimes it's those veterans, sometimes it's not. And I remember last year, Alex, one of those trackers was pretty much just running in circles, and one of them took off way out into the ice, and it scared quite a few people. They thought he was in the middle of the ocean. Do you remember that?
I do. That was Karen Ramstead's tracker, and for a while it had its own Facebook page, and I think it had, you know, several thousand likes on Facebook, and people were posting updates for where the tracker was. It was very amusing.
Yeah, so there's still a lot of race left. Well, she's on record. She said Allie Zirkle. I know you are big into superstition and jinxing folks, and we didn't really get one from you. But I said Allie and Ramey Smith were my predictions for the race. I guess we're 8 days into it. I'm still rooting. I root for everybody. I would love to see any of these guys come up and really give us a heck of a race, and they appear to be doing so. So I look forward to the next few days, at least here on the radio.
Absolutely, and I think you did pressure me into making a pick, and I picked Allie as well.
Oh, my goodness.
Having said that, you know, having Martin Boozer or Mitch Seavey or Aaron Burmeister or Jeff King or win this race would be fantastic as well.
It would. Any of the top 15 or so are excellent ambassadors for the sport and will definitely give the support the recognition that it deserves. And, boy, I tell you what, I've seen him go up in the standings here since the beginning. You're awesome. Man, he's putting on one heck of a race as a rookie.
Yeah. He is perhaps putting on one of the most impressive races I've seen for a rookie.
There you go. All right, Alex, we'll talk again tomorrow. On behalf of my co-host tonight, Michelle Forto, sitting in here on the radio, and our Iditarod coverage expert, Alex Stein, calling in from California. I'll talk to you again tomorrow. Okay, Alex?
Okay. Thanks, guys.
All right. That was Mushroom Radio Day 9 coverage. We'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.